This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is, of course, our customary Wednesday night feature here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike Penna, along with my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and very happy to have you joining me all across North America on Sirius 220, XM 206, and for those of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net, welcome to the program. As you know, this is a show where each week I have the privilege of visiting with the men and women who play such a huge role in making this sport a success. And of course, you know, I'm talking about the trainers. And one of the things I enjoy most when talking to trainers is hearing about their journey and the various highs and lows they've experienced on their way to achieving their goals. Many of the stories are somewhat similar, but trust me, none are the same. And with that being said, I'm thrilled to welcome retired trainer Frank Brothers to the program here tonight. He's a native of New Orleans. He enjoyed a stellar 40-year training career before retiring at the age of 62 in 2009. He saddled 2,359 career winners. His runners accumulated nearly $49 million in purse earnings, and you can still find him around the racetrack and in attendance at most of the major thoroughbred sales as he enjoys his new career as a bloodstock advisor. Frankie, thanks so much for taking the time.
Mike, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, welcome to the program. And I'll tell you what, when you hear me go through those kind of numbers and think back on this illustrious career that you were fortunate to have, it's been quite a ride, my friend.
Well, no question about it. You know, training is not an I sport. It's a we sport. And there was a lot of wonderful horses, a lot of wonderful owners and employees and riders and on that went into all of that. So it's I've just been a very blessed guy and got some fortunate breaks along the way, and it's worked out. And I got to a point where I was able to retire. I never did think I would really die with my boots on, as they say. but it's been a great career, and the best part about it is I've been able to kind of continue on buying yearlings and being a bloodstock advisor to some clients, notably Starlight Racing and a few other guys that. So it's really been a lot of fun, and it leaves me time to do, whatever that I want to do. So it's been a good role, and I've got no complaints.
Yeah, let's make that clear. You've never actually fully left the sport. You are still involved doing some bloodstock work for some different clients, and that has to really help fill that void, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, what are you going to do? I've been a horse guy all my life, and I did think it was time to move on from the training, and I do not train anymore, and I don't hang out at the racetrack, so to speak. I like to go out Derby Week. We live in Louisville, Kentucky, so Derby Week's fun to see the horses. And occasionally we go to Florida, like during the winter, for a little R&R and see some of the Starlight horses run and go to Ocala and see the babies and stuff like that. So I enjoy doing those things there, and it's been a good role.
What's your earliest memory of first being introduced to the sport and to the racetrack?
Well, it probably started, I was a city boy, always thinking about playing a country boy's game. For some reason, I was infatuated with horses. My dad was an electrician. There was nobody in my family that was in the horse business, anything like that. My grandfather was a bookmaker, but it was kind of a tradition in our family in those years to go to the fairgrounds, opened up on Thanksgiving Day, and we would go out to the races, although I was very, very small, but my dad would take me out there. And so I guess that would be my first action around the horses, and I just was infatuated with them. And then in in sixth grade, he bought me a pony for $100. So you can imagine what that was. But he was a great pony. I didn't know how to ride, and he was bomb proof, as they say. And I'd fall off, and he'd stand there and look at me, you know. So it moved on after that a little bit. But he bought me a $600 quarter horse, which, you know, that's not a lot of money for one of those. And she wound up being like a rags to riches horse. Be like buying a grade one winner for 600. And she could do a lot of the Western events there. And pretty much we taught each other, but she probably taught me more than I taught her. And was fortunate enough to win a bunch of room full of ribbons, trophies, and saddles and stuff like that, just going to the little shows and around Louisiana, Mississippi, and places like that on the weekends, you know. And so I probably went to more horse shows than I went to school, to tell you the truth. And school and I really didn't get along too well. And then...
Did you actually think that you might want to pursue a career as a jockey when you were showing all the national caliber quarter horses that you were?
Well, I was probably small enough at the time, but I, you know, my father was not small, and my mother wasn't small. I mean, I knew I'd actually ridden a couple of match races, to tell you the truth, sometime when I was showing the quarter horses there, and that didn't pan out really too well, to tell you the truth. But it was a lot of fun, and I wound up. As I said, school wasn't good for me. I went to five grammar schools. Three high schools, and took me 5 years to get through high school. And I went to less than half a semester at college, in which I just took time and space, so to speak. And after that was over with, I was standing there realizing I couldn't eat that room full of trophies and saddles that I had, and didn't have any money and didn't have much education. So that kind of drove me to the racetrack. It was the time of year the horses were in New Orleans, and I did know that if a guy had some luck, maybe you could make some money with the thoroughbreds. You know, it's pretty tough to make it in the quarter horse, but to tell you the truth. But so I went to work for Jack Vanberg as a hot walker, and, you know, worked for him for 10 years and did everything you could possibly do, ate all the barbed wire he'd give you. He, you know, never took anybody by the hand, but if you worked hard, you know, he would reward you. And I worked my way up to one of his assistants, and actually part of that time, or towards the end of that time, one of my colleagues and a gentleman that you have on your show, you told me, Billy Mott, we were the two gallop horses for Jack at Oak Lawn one winter. Jack had lost the Shinrone horses, which was about 200 horses, and was down to about 20 horses. So Billy and I were the two gallop horses, and Jack would pony the horses, and then he built back up to a powerful stable, you know, after that. Billy went out on his own, and I hung around a few more years and then went out on my own, you know. So that's kind of how that got started there.
Wow. What do you remember about that first day when you walked into Jack's barn?
I was horrified. He was pretty intimidating, you know. Jack, great, great guy, and he was a wonderful mentor, and I've got no regrets, but I think I walked 10 horses that morning. The next day, I had blisters on my feet. Went from wearing boots to tennis shoes to thinking maybe I'm not cut out for this. I actually got there one morning, got out of my car, and got back in my car. And said, I can't do this. I don't know if I can walk that many horses. You know, my feet were so sore. And anyway, I got back out of the car and went to work. And I was, you know, it was kind of the crossroads of my career, really. You know, one thing led to another, and got to rub horses, got to be the foreman, got to gallop horses, got to be the assistant, and take them to the gate and clip horses. I mean, you just, you know, with Jack, you had to do kind of everything if you were going to get anywhere with him, you know. So, and he finally, you know, rewarded his assistants. You know, each one would have a division. I think Billy went to Chicago, and I went to Oak Lawn, and then to Omaha, you know, and did that for a few years, and then the circuits change as they do, you know. So,
well, Frankie, you were obviously old enough to make your own decisions at that point. What did your parents think about you pursuing a career in racing, especially after you attended college and then left to get back involved with racing?
Well, they didn't think too much of it, to tell you the truth. My dad didn't like it. I'm forever thankful for him buying me a horse, which gave me a career, but we weren't as close as we probably should be. And we got further apart when I went to work on the racetrack. You know, he kind of just thought, well, he'd just be a bum, you know, or whatever. And
really?
So it just, he came around later, but, you know, that's just a personal thing. We just weren't that close, but I was bound determined that I was, felt like the good Lord gave me a little bit of common sense and a little bit of a feel for a horse. I never did think I had any special talents, but I was always very comfortable and happy at the barn around the horses, probably more so than people, to tell you the truth, you know, but it was even though you work very hard and it's a labor of love, which I've got no regrets about, but it's just, I was just comfortable there with the horses and, you know, was fortunate through the years to get some breaks and to kind of make it, you know, so.
Are you still the only member of your family that ever pursued a career in racing?
My younger brother, Bobby, he was with me forever. My assistant, he's the foreman, one of the foremen for Billy Mott, here at Churchill. And actually he's on his way to Florida right now. But so when I retired, he went to work for Billy. But that would be the only one. There's nobody else in my family. He kind of came along with me when I, went out on my own, you know, so.
Talking with trainer Frankie Brothers here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Frankie, you mentioned when you went to work for Jack Vanberg, you said he wouldn't take you by the hand, and he was somebody that wasn't going to coddle you. Are you, looking back now, are you glad that you initially learned from somebody like that?
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, it was a school of hard knocks, you know. I mean, we got to the barn in the morning, it was dark, and when you left, it was dark, you know, and the majority of days, there would be no going home for lunch or nothing like that. You know, you just stayed at the racetrack all day. And, you know, we, in those years, he had hundreds of horses, you know, probably averaged about 200 horses or 250 horses at the different racetracks. So, you know, there was just always work to be done, you know, and most people didn't want to do it. It wasn't like you got a big paycheck by no means, you know. I think my first check was for 6 days, but I cleared $30 and probably walking 8 to 10 horses a day. And I was going to keep the check. I said, I'll just keep this check here, but I couldn't do that because I got hungry. I needed to eat. So, you know, it just that only lasted a couple of days that I was going to keep that check. So it's just... But he was the best at the time, and I think I'm partial, but I think he's one of the greatest horsemen of his era, and his stats probably prove that, you know. He didn't have the top quality horses when I was with him. You know, we had some nice, as we call Saturday horses, but we won a lot of races, and you got to see a lot of things, and you couldn't help but learn if you just, you know, paid attention, that's all. So it just... It was a wonderful schooling, and I don't regret. I don't know that I had to stay there 10 years. I did. I've got no regrets for that. But you surely learned. And I had a couple of opportunities along the way to go to work for a couple of guys. And with his blessing, I looked into it, but I didn't take them. And thank God I didn't. It just, they didn't particularly work out. And then I think in 1980, I had a chance to go on my own. Albert Stahl, who was the father of the young Albert that trains now, gave me an opportunity to train some of his horses and some of his friends' horses and kind of staked me in getting, you know, tack and stuff like that to go on my own. And we went to Shreveport that right after the fairgrounds meet there, and I think I was wound up being lead trained the first year there. Went there with about 16 horses and left with about 40 or 50 of them, and just kind of went from there, you know. So,
well, you mentioned Al Stahl Sr., and Al Stahl Jr. joined me on this program several months back, and I can remember that when I asked him about his background, Frankie, he spoke in glowing terms about you, and he said you were like family to him, and he told me that you probably had the biggest influence on his career. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means an awful lot. I felt like little Al, or young Al, you know, worked for me. And even before he did that, I mean, it seems like his father took me in as a son, so to speak. You know, I would go places with him. I always go to dinner. He'd go to his house. He bought me clothes. He would, you know, give me some of his old shirts and stuff like that, you know, which they weren't old. But when Al expressed an interest, I mean, he'd always spend a little time around the, we in New Orleans around the barn, but when he really wanted to get serious about it, it gave me an opportunity to kind of give back, so to speak, and help him as best I could. And we are like family, you know. It's just it's kind of a cool thing, and I was so proud of him, you know, with the job he did with Blame, and of course the job he does with all of his horses. He's a top class trainer, but that was really special when you know, he won the Breeders' Cup Classic with Blame and beat Zenyatta. So I mean, that was really a good deal. And and like I said, Al in his own right has done very well, and so it's been a good situation. But you don't, in life, you don't come across a lot of people like that. The Stahl family that, you know, gave me a break, and I was fortunate enough to take advantage of that, paying back everything, and, you know, had my own stable role, and, you know, after he helped me get going and trained for him for a lot of years, and the friendship that I've had with him and his family through the years, it's been a wonderful thing, you know.
Yeah, he told me that working with you was like getting a Harvard education. What was your philosophy in teaching young trainers?
Just like the same philosophy as Vanberg in teaching me, just give them all a bob where they could eat, that's all. And they just, you know, just kind of pour it to them, because it's a tough business, you know. It's a really tough business. But I mean, I would take, if somebody had the interest and would work hard, then I would take the time to, you know, if they asked me something, to explain something to them, or tell them why, you know, why this or why that. And, you know, they see the things that work, they see the things that don't work. And it's pretty much a trial and error business, to tell you the truth, you know. But I mean, there's basic ways of doing things, and then there's, you know, then you have to improvise and figure out this horse is different, that horse is different, and, you know, what do you do, or what do you try to do, you know, so.
What's the most important thing that a trainer can do with a horse, Frankie?
Oh, I think to keep them healthy, preventive. But I mean by preventive, I mean, I think, you know, it's with Jack, you know, you look at every horse every day, you know, check their legs and watch them jog either down the street or jog right off, you know, and you could see them going, and if they weren't right, then you brought them back, and if they weren't, you know, their legs weren't right or something was coming up, they didn't go out to the racetrack, you know. And so I think preventive, and then, you know, keeping them healthy and happy and fit, you know. It's I mean, a lot of horses are overtrained. I mean, they're athletes, and if you're going to run, you have to train, just like the two-legged athletes. But I think keeping them healthy and fit and happy is a major deal, you know.
You know, when you were learning from Jack, you were part of so many memorable moments and special moments in his career. In 1976, he set the record for the most wins in a year with 496, and he was also the U.S. champion thoroughbred trainer by earnings that year. What do you remember about that season, and what was it like?
A lot of work. We ran some horses, I'm telling you, especially towards the end when it got close, you know. But it was like a factory. But I mean, it was a well-oiled factory, I'll tell you that. I mean, he had great assistance and great help, and he had his system, and everybody knew it, and that's what you did, you know. There were no days off. I mean, you ran every day. You'd run four, five, six horses a day. That was just the way of life, and that's what you did, you know. So, but it was a lot of fun to get that accomplished. And, you know, his dad was leading trainer a number of years before he took over. You know, his dad passed away and got sick, and then he passed away. He didn't last long, and then Jack just picked right up where his dad took off, which you would say, well, that's normal, but it's not necessarily normal. I mean, I've seen people, and you probably have in different businesses and the horse business, that just because they get something handed to them doesn't mean it'll roll right along, you know. And Jack, it rolled right along for him, and it's amazing the people that have come out of his, I wouldn't say school because it wasn't a school, but some of his people that worked for him, the assistants that went on to do well, you know, it's a pretty good list there, I'll tell you, which is a testament to him.
Well, you mentioned taking out, well, I guess going out on your own right around 1980. How did you know that was the right time to make that move?
Well, I don't know. I think you just get a feel for it, and I had a. Actually, the true story is that there was a guy named Mike Rutherford who's still in the horse business from Houston and a good friend of mine, and had some horses for Jack, and he wanted me to go train privately for him in Southern California, and it was a very good job. To train some nice horses. He didn't have that many, but to train some nice, well-bred horses. And I was pretty much forced to take that job. I mean, if I was ever going to make a move, this was going to be the job, you know. And actually, Mr. Stahl said, I don't want you to go to California. He said, I want you to train for me. He said, I don't have any money or nothing like that, because Mike was going to pay for everything and then give me a nice salary and percentage and all that kind of stuff. And he said, I'll give you some horses. I'll bankroll you. And I'll get some of my buddies to buy some claims. We'll claim some horses and buy some yearlings or whatever. So he's the one that, at the last minute, who didn't take a lot of swaying, really, other than both of those guys are my friends, Mike and Al. But I thought I would be better off with a public stable than a private stable. I mean, and like Mike, actually, Mike, he gave me horses to train that same summer, a few of them that didn't go to California, he sent them to me at Louisiana Downs, and we had a lot of luck. But Mike told me later, he said, oh, I would have just fired you, he said, because we really didn't have that many good horses. And he said, you did the right thing, about, you know, going to get a public stable or opening up a public stable. So that's actually how that came along, you know.
Wow.
It was kind of time to go, and I had an offer that I couldn't refuse, and then I got another offer that I just definitely couldn't refuse, and I thought it would be better to have my own business than to train privately, you know, at that point in my career, you know. So,
how many horses did you have when you first started?
I think we went to Shreveport with like 16 horses. I bought some at the end of the meet at the fairgrounds, bought six or eight of them, I think, and Albert had four or five or six to train. A couple of his buddies had a horse or two. And so it started out there, and then at the end of that summer, I think we had 40 or 50 horses, you know, and wound up was able to beat my mentor Jack for the leading trainer just by a few, but we beat him for the leading trainer, which was
wow.
A lot of fun between us both. You know, we both got a pretty good laugh out of that, you know. So.
Yeah, what was that? Did you really want to beat him? Was that a main focus of yours?
Well, no, not really. It's just, I'm just, you know, going 100 miles an hour like a bat out of hell. Just, you know, I was trying to make it, you know, that's all. And it just looked up and, you know, things just kind of fell into place there. And, you know, he was always tough to outrun, but it just worked out that way. But it didn't start out, well, I'm going to, you know, outrun him. I never thought I could, to tell you the truth, but it just worked out that way. That's all. So.
Wow. Talking with trainer Frank Brothers here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Frankie, you were based, as you mentioned, starting in Louisiana Downs and then Fairgrounds, and you were based there for a number of years before you finally spread your operation to Oaklawn and Kentucky. When you did that present a whole new set of challenges for you?
Well, it did. It was quite a bit different. I guess 9 years I've stayed pretty much in Louisiana Downs, go to the fairgrounds in the winter, run some horses at Oaklawn. I think two winters we want to be in lead train at Oaklawn, and would always take a couple of horses to Keeneland and maybe run some Derby week if I had a couple of nice horses. Some guys wanted to do that, so that's you know pretty much what I did, and I was happy staying around Louisiana there. And then in '89, a guy named Joe Albritton. He's from Houston, but his farm was in Upperville, Virginia, the Lazy Lane farm. He'd sent me a couple of horses to train that didn't do in New York, and we had some luck, and Actually, my buddy Mike Rutherford is the one got Joe to send me some horses, you know, the guy I was going to go to work for originally. And so Joe decided he wanted to get in the game a little bit more and wanted to have his own trainer, and basically offered me a deal that I just couldn't refuse. I had a five-year contract with a big contract for a horse trainer and for 5 years, and, you know, guaranteed salary plus this, plus that, and, you know. And I could buy some yearlings. It was an opportunity. He bred some horses, but he sold a lot of them, too, through the sales. But I had a chance to buy my own horses, so to speak, with a few homebreds. And it was a different challenge, and it was going from probably training, averaging about 125 horses for 9 or 10 years to probably 25 or 35 horses, which is, you know, just like one barn, so to speak. And you know, the water would be deeper, but you'd have a, you know, it was a different challenge. And in other words, I could buy them as babies and break them and take them all the way up, you know. And I thought that was a bigger challenge than dropping one for 20,000 to 10 to win a race, you know.
Yeah.
So I decided to give up the public stable, and I thought, well, if I could keep this job and the money he's paying me, I'd be in pretty good shape, even if I had to start over again. And that surely worked out. So I worked for Joe, I guess, 4 or 5 years or something like that. And, you know, we were fortunate to come up with a horse. And the first bunch we bought was a horse called Secret, although won a grade one. The second bunch was, and we only bought 6 or 8 or 10 horses, you know, per year. But the second bunch would have been Hansel, the horse that won the Preakness and the Belmont, was the champion 3-year-old of his year. And I think the next year was a homebred that won the grade one at Del Mar, 2-year-old. And next year we had a horse win the Del Mar Derby. And so we had some luck, and Joe decided he wanted to cut back a little bit. He wasn't feeling well. And I had a chance, Seth Hancock at Claiborne Farm, which was a wonderful opportunity. And as much as I love Seth, he can be a little tough to train for, but he was my man. And he offered me a deal to train privately or semi-privately for Claiborne, and so that was my next adventure. There was to work for Claiborne, and we had some, you know, you always want to do better. I think you can do more. We bought a few yearlings. One was a horse called Archer, was a top class horse, and wound up being a great sire, which is, that's Claiborne's been big, you know, they're in the sire business, that's for sure. And we had another horse called Mighty that we bought, and he won the Louisiana Derby. And I was fortunate that Pulpit was in the first bunch, I think, that I trained for Seth. And he was probably the most brilliant horse that I trained. Not the most accomplished, but the most brilliant.
Well, Frankie, I'm glad you brought up the name Pulpit, because we're going to spend a little time in the second half of the program talking about Pulpit, talking about Hansel. We're going to do that next, right after we pause here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It's never too early to start talking about the Fasig Tipton Florida sale. Mark your calendar now for this premier 2-year-old and training sale on Wednesday, March 4th, with the Under Tax Show taking place Monday, March 2nd. 2014 graduates of the Florida sale include Grade 1 hopeful winner, Competitive Edge.
Competitive Edge makes it 2 for 2 here at the spa. Competitive Edge, the winner by 4.5 lengths.
Grade 2 Saratoga Special Hero, I Spent It.
I Spent It, a dramatic winner of the Saratoga Special.
And Blofeld, winner of the Grade 2 Futurity.
Blofeld at the rail. Here comes Blofeld to win the Futurity.
With the 2014 sale boasting the highest average and second highest median of all 2-year-old sales, the Fasig Tipton Florida sale is the place to be. Nominations are now being accepted. So log on to FasigTipton.com and nominate today.
For racing coverage from the inside out.
I still kicked away, and I thought I really had it until the 16th pole. Amazing little horse.
International English events.
A clear round and under the time limit will get you into the jump off.
And hard-fought Western competition.
Here we go, guys. Let's help him. You bet. Woo!
Tune in to HRTV, the network for horse sports. Online at HRTV.com.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
The Daily Racing Form NTRA National Handicapping Championship is coming off the most exciting championship in the event's 15-year history. Virtually every tournament this year, on track and online, is filling to capacity, and the purse for the 2015 NHC is expected to be $2 million, and there's still plenty of time to join the tour and get in on the action. NHC Tour membership is only $50 and includes all sorts of discounts and special offers on DRF past performance and other products. Go to nhctour.com today. That's nhctour.com.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
The claiming crown.
Nevada Kid holding on to the lead. Flatter This closing on the outside. Dominant Jeans on the rail. Nevada Kid wires them in the claiming crown jewel.
Live from Gulfstream Park. Exclusively on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Saturday, December 6th. Coverage begins at 2:30 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Kitten's Joy. Standing at Ramsey Farm.
Hey everyone, Mike Penna here along with jockey Christina McManigal, and do we have some big news for you.
Starting Tuesday, December 16th, you can join us for our brand new Jock Talk show from 6 to 7 Eastern.
Jock Talk? Sounds like that might be right up your alley, Christina.
Haha, you know it. Every Tuesday night, we'll give you a unique look into the lives and backgrounds of racing's top jockeys, both past and present.
It should be amazing, so join us every Tuesday night from 6 to 7 Eastern for Jock Talk, beginning Tuesday, December 16th, streaming live and podcast exclusively on our HRN website, horseracingradio.net.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasic Tipton.
This is Eddie Delahoussaye. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, continuing my visit with retired trainer Frank Brothers. And boy, an enjoyable first half of the program. Really looking forward to hearing more stories in the second half. If you miss any portion of this show and want to listen to it later, you can do it each and every week on our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast is available. And of course, you can always listen on iTunes and listen on your smartphone, tablet, wherever you may be. You can listen to Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. We wrapped up the first part of the show talking about that year, 1989, and Joe Allbritton, and working with Joe at Lazy Lane Farms, Frankie, and that really was the beginning of some special things for you. You mentioned the name Secret Hello, and Secret Hello was a horse that provided you with your first Grade One victory in the Arlington Washington Futurity. I know that had to be extremely special for you to win that very first Grade One.
Well, there was no question about it, and then to win it for Mr. Allbritton, I mean, that's, you know, that's what he was in the game for. That's what everybody's in the game for, I guess. But and he was, I think we bought, I don't know, six or eight yearlings that year, and he was a high-priced one. but he was a man amongst boys, and to accomplish it as a 2-year-old, what he did was pretty remarkable. Actually, he got beat in the prep to the Arlington Futurity, and he was like 3-5 or 2-5 in the prep, and he had a fast horse stole off on him, a nice horse, but anyway, he was second, but he came back and won the Arlington Futurity. And in a little side story, the morning of the Arlington Futurity, I get a call. Pat Day is supposed to be on him. Pat never has an injury. I mean, he's been a remarkable rider, you know, but he went down the day before, sprained his wrist or something like that. Nothing terrible, but he wasn't going to ride that day. So I rode a young bug boy by the name of Aaron Grider, who's actually been a nice rider through the years, you know. So went from having the premier rider to giving a young guy, Aaron, who was quite capable, had the bug. It didn't make any difference in that race as far as the weight. But anyway, he won the Arlington Futurity. So that was a little drama that morning, but it worked out fine.
That was also the same year that you won the Arkansas Derby with Dansel, and he would take you to your first Kentucky Derby. Tell me about that experience.
Well, Dancer was a small horse. He had kind of sore feet, but you know, he kind of shuffled along, and then he warmed up, and he was fine. I say sore feet. He was a very thin walled horse, and but he tried every time, and it was quite a thrill to win the Arkansas Derby for Mr. Franks. I think at that time that was probably the biggest race that he'd won. And Mr. Franks was one of my biggest boosters when I went on my own. So it was very rewarding for me and for him to win that race there. And we took him on to Kentucky, and he just came around the wrong year. I mean, Easy Goer and Sunday Silence were that year, and they're turning for home about the 5/16 pole, and he rolls up to within about a length of him and got a call. And I'm thinking he's got a shot until they straightened out and the running started, and he wound up fourth. But I mean, he ran his heart out, and I was always so proud of that little horse for doing that. And of course, it was Sunday Silence and Easy Goer all through the Triple Crown there, you know, and yeah, they were just tremendous horses. But so that was, you know, we ran him back in the Preakness, and he tried hard again. He was fourth, and then that was it. We gave him some time off, you know. But those that was a pretty exciting time. At the time, I thought I had a live horse in the Derby, and he was live. He was fourth. He ran as best he could, but he couldn't top those other two horses, you know. So,
well, it took you a couple of years to get back, which really, in terms of the Kentucky Derby, is not a long period at all. You returned in 1991 with Hansel, who you mentioned before the commercial break, and Hansel, of course, purchased by Mr. Allbritton at the Keeneland September Yearling Sale. That was in 1989. Did you have a hand in the selection process with Hansel?
Actually, I did. I was fortunate enough to pick him out as a yearling. In those years, I would go to the farms before the sales and look at some of the horses, the babies, and I saw him. And this was before the summer sale, when they used to have the summer sale, and they said they were going to sell him in the fall, and I just walked him down. I said, I'll find that horse because I'm going to buy him. I put down a price of $50,000. It was Woodman's first year at stud. Of course, Woodman wanted to be in a top class stallion, but at that point, nobody knew, you know, if he would make it or not. You know, he was just another European horse came over, you know, with American pedigree, wound up giving. We gave $150,000 for him, and he was just he was a man amongst boys just from day one. Really, sending to Texas to be broke at Two Creek Ranch. Johnny Jones had a place there, and they probably had 60 or 80 yearlings down there, and coming 2-year-olds, and he was just a man. He just stood out, you know, and he had a good 2-year-old year and good 3-year-old year. So
how much different was that Kentucky Derby experience the second time around when you went there with Hansel?
Well, from a trainer, I never try to get too high on horses. I always let them show me, you know. But he was a little hard not to get high on. He'd won the two preps before the Kentucky Derby. He was a morning line favorite, which, you know, I'd rather be that than 20-1. But it doesn't make you get there of the Derby. And, you know, you couldn't find him in the Derby. So it just, and then he was fortunate to win the two after the Derby. So you can't say, well, you know, you ran him too much. He was on a downswing, or you should have done this, you should have done that. Because, I mean, he was lights out the two races before the Derby, and he was lights out the two races after the Derby. You know, it's just, he was a free-running horse. He kind of had to have things his own way. And you, in the Derby, you just, most of the horses, you just don't get that, you know. And that, I guess that's what makes the Derby the Derby. And he had a little adversity and didn't have things his own way. And at the quarter pole, he looked like a goose with his head sticking up, backing up, you know. It's just... And I was, that's probably as disappointed as I've ever been, because I thought I was so close, but yet so far away. You know, I really thought that year I had a great chance to win the Kentucky Derby, more so than Dansel. I knew Dansel, I felt like he was live, but I was aware of the other, you know, Sunday Silence and Easy Goer. And then once I saw him, you could see the big strapping horses, and this little horse here is going to try, but I don't know if he can beat them. But Hansel was, you know, he was a top class horse, and it just, It didn't work out, and I was extremely disappointed. And actually, the next morning we were stable in Arlington that year. I put him back on a van the next morning, brought him back to our home base at Arlington, which is only 6 hours. It's not like it's a big deal. And I got him back there and just was going to evaluate him for a week or 10 days, something like that. And before I decided, you know, to go to the Preakness, not go to the Preakness, but I didn't want to go on to Baltimore. Because then you just, you know, you'll just be talking yourself into running if you do that. So we went back and blew him out about it. And I think 8 or 9 days after he ran just a little easy 3/8, and he was just wild because he really didn't run much in the Derby. And so I called Mr. Albritton and I told him, you know, he kind of wanted to go. And I said, well, I couldn't tell you not to go, but because he's good, and you know, the rest is history.
How rewarding was his win in the Preakness, considering what happened to him in the Kentucky Derby?
Well, at that point, it was the most rewarding race I'd ever won. You know, that's for sure. You know, because you felt like you knew your horse, you felt like you had a good horse, and he ran his race. And I mean, I wish, you know, you can never go back. You'd wish he'd have done that in the Derby. He's a horse that, you know, probably with a little luck, you know, you probably could say that about some horses through the years. With a little luck, he could have been a Triple Crown winner. You know, he had the ability that particular year, was that kind of horse, you know, but it just, he won 2 out of 3, and I was very, very appreciative to win 2 out of 3. I was very appreciative to win 1 out of 3, to tell you the truth, you know. So it just, you know, guys go along in their career, and, you know, you never get that close to things like that. You know, it doesn't happen, and some guys who can build up that kind of quality of horse and clientele, I mean, they get to go, you know, a lot more often than some other people, you know. So,
well, as high as you were on Hansel in 1991 with that Derby, you had to be equally as high going into the Derby in 97 with a little horse by the name of Pulpit, because he was brilliant and he came into the race at the top of his game. Tell me a little bit about that Derby and going there with Pulpit.
Well, he had a brilliant race in the Bluegrass. He was a little disappointing. We took him back in the Florida Derby. He was third, I believe, second or third. And first time we'd taken him back, and that didn't work. He was a free running horse. He'd won the Fountain of Youth before that. I think he won 3 out of 3 races in Florida and was second or third in the Florida Derby and second. And so kind of freshened him up. Got up here in the cold weather, you know, in the spring there, and he ran lights out in the Bluegrass, and you know, we thought we were good to go in the Derby. I mean, he was, I believe, the morning line favorite, and felt like we had a hell of a shot if he, and I remember from Hansel that, you know, he was taken out of his game, and we wasn't going to let that happen with Pulpit, and kind of let him roll away from that. He was a free run horse also, and you know, he made the lead and looked like he was on his way there, and he was, and was wound up being a disappointing fourth. But the bottom line is he came out, he shattered his knee in the Derby, and I say shattered it. I mean, he had about a half a test tube full of chips taken out of his knee after the Derby. Pulled up fine. I mean, he was cooled out fine. The next morning, he was pretty sore, and you know, we X-rayed him, and of course, the results were there. So, you know, you couldn't hold that race against him. I mean, he was a horse, you know, probably with the nothing against the horses that, you know, that beat him, but I mean, he was probably going to be a big player there if that doesn't happen. So, that's part of racing, and I understood that, and he really showed a lot of guts just to hang on to be fourth, to tell you the truth, considering all the things that happened, and he never started after that. But he was an extremely brilliant horse, extremely brilliant, very hot, but a very brilliant horse, and he's been a world-class sire and a world-class sire of sires.
Which loss was more difficult to get over, Frankie, Hansel or Pulpit?
I would say Hansel, because Pulpit wound up with an excuse. You know, he blew his knee out in the Derby. You know, so that, I mean, I was heartbroken there, but I knew what happened. And the other horse just, you know, he just was taken out of his game. You know, it's just, I mean, he won the two classics after that, so it wasn't like he was on a downswing or anything was wrong. I mean, this, that, you know, what all the many things that horses do or don't do, but I would say I was pretty upset with Hansel, to tell you the truth.
You know, I know you can't control injuries in this sport, well, in any sport, but do you ever kind of feel like Pulpit just had some unfinished business?
Well, I mean, if he would have stayed sound, and you could probably say that about a number of horses, you know, through the years. He would have been a player the rest of the year in some of those races. And there's no question about it. I mean, he was one of the better 3-year-olds of his generation, and if he's 100% sound, maybe he wins the Derby. Maybe he doesn't. But I mean, I think he had a big shot that day if he don't blow his knee out. And of course, that the career was over there. But I mean, talent wise, if nothing happened to him, he would have been a player the rest of the year. There's no question about it.
Retired trainer Frank Brothers joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Frankie, in that Derby with Pulpit, you gave a leg up to Shane Sellers. And I know you had a very special relationship with Shane. You still do. He says you are like a father figure to him. Tell me about that relationship and how that came about.
Well, he was Cajun Rider, you know. I mean, they make them down there. They breed them down there. It's amazing. But he was an excellent rider, and we kind of got together in Chicago, and then he came to Kentucky, and he just always rode the horses, and we got along well. And he started getting better and better, and you know, he'd get his head down, and I'd kind of bite him in the tail a little bit and chew on him, and you know, get him jacked up again, and it just worked out for us, you know, he was a terrific rider. There's no question about it. It took a lot of some years for some people to realize that, but I always thought from day one he was the top class rider. And Seth Hancock decided to give him a chance on Pulpit and stayed with him, you know. So I thought that was probably at that time the best horse he had ridden probably at that point. And after that, he rode many nice horses, but that was probably at that point, the best horse he had ridden.
Well, Frankie, there were so many other outstanding horses you were part of. We don't have time to talk about all of them, but Madcap Escapade and First Samurai, Mighty Arch. I mean, you think back to some of these horses that you were around, and it's quite remarkable, really. You decide to retire in 2009 at the age of 62. You still had a lot of good years left in you, but how did you know that the time was right to step away?
Well, I tell you, I trained probably for Joe Allbritton, and then for a number of years, and then went to work for Claiborne Farm for a number of years, and then Joe wanted to get back in the game, and wound up going back to work for Joe for a few years there. And I'd say the half of my career, I had a public stable, and the other half of my career trained privately or semi-privately for those two farms there, and. And then when that was over, I did a couple of years. My buddy Bruce Lunsford let me buy some yearlings, and we were fortunate to buy Madcap Escapade and First Samurai and a filly called Tessa Blue. And there was a couple other ones, another grade two went out. I can't think of her name right now. Bel Air Beauty. And so that was about, I guess, 3 or 4 years there that we had some luck. I didn't have a lot of horses, but had a couple of top-class horses, and so that kind of wound down a little bit, and I just thought, my chances of getting better horses are getting a little slimmer and slimmer, and I never did want to stand around and kick the tires, and I never was one to go out and, you know, hustle anybody, whether that was right or wrong, but I just never did. And I thought, I'm just going to retire. I had about 20 horses in my stable and try to do maybe a little bloodstock work just to kind of keep my hand in the game. And I was fortunate enough to have the wherewithal for a trainer anyway, a little guy, to be able to do that. I mean, a lot of them just can't do that, you know. So I was extremely lucky and have no regrets. I do miss the horses some, but I don't necessarily miss the business. And, you know, with buying yearlings, and I do work for Keeneland, the sales company, about 6 weeks a year during the summer on the selection team to pick out the horses for the September sale, which is a lot of fun. And most of them are over in Lexington, and I live in Louisville, and so it's not a big deal there. And so that's about 6 weeks. And then I'll go to like three sales, and Starlight's been a wonderful, wonderful client to have the faith in me to help them pick out some yearlings. And we've had some luck. And we've had some bad luck like everybody else also. But so it just kind of worked out. But it was time for me, I thought, to move on from the game. And I was just fortunate that I could move on.
You know, I'm always curious, whenever somebody walks away from a profession that they've been part of for so long, like you were with training horses, what are those first few days or even weeks like after you make the decision? Do you wake up in the morning saying, oh, no, what have I done for those first couple of days?
No, I never did. I mean, I thought the last couple of years I trained that I was going to retire. I mean, we had First Samurai, we had, you know, Madcap Escapade, which they'll make you get up out of bed, those kind of horses. They were top class. And I knew when their time was up that, I mean, unless there was one behind them, you know, a good horse will always make you stay there, you know, but unless there was one behind them, that was probably going to be the end of it. So I kind of planned it, and I was fine. I try to stay in bed till 6. My eyes are wide awake at 4. Usually I'm looking at the clock, but because I would always be at the barn at 5 o'clock, a little bit before 5, you know. But I try to hang in there till 6 before I get up. And I've just really got, you know, the next guy could be different, but I've got no regrets about that, to tell you the truth.
And you're married to one of the top female riders in all of thoroughbred racing, Donna Brothers. She retired from riding in 1998. She worked with you, actually, galloping horses for some time after her retirement. What was that like to have her by your side and be able to work together to achieve your goals?
Well, she's the best thing that's happened to me. I mean, when we got engaged, she retired from racing, which I was glad she did. She had a wonderful career. And if she'd have wanted to continue to ride, that would have been fine with me. But I was surely glad that she decided not to ride, because I just was fearful that she'd get hurt or something like that, you know. And so she loved the horses and would come to the barn and, you know, breeze the horses and gallop the horses. And so it was sometimes those type of relationships don't work, you know, when your wife or girlfriend is, you know, you work with them. Sometimes that can be tough, and sometimes it can be wonderful. You know, it was wonderful for us. And, you know, I mean, ability-wise, she's great, you know. And we, you know, that part of it worked really, really good. And so I've got no regrets. And like I said, she's the best thing that's happened to me. And it's been all good.
Well, people will know Donna now as being part of the NBC broadcast team for the Triple Crown, the Breeders' Cup, and so many other events throughout the year. How cool is it being able to watch your wife on TV?
It's good. She'll call and she wants me to critique her, you know, and not that I know much about those things, but I can tell through the years now, I can tell, you know, what's good and what's bad. And, you know, I like those interviews, I can tell if the rider doesn't speak much English, they're telling her in their ear to move on, you know, because when she gets to asking the questions and having to answer them also, then she's got to move on, you know. So, but it's pretty cool. And since I've retired, I don't go to all of events with it, but I'll go to some of them and, you know, enjoy it. I love to see the horses, because it's usually, you know, a nice race or races that she's covering, you know. And, you know, we go to Saratoga in the summer, do a little business with the sale up there. That takes about a week. And then she usually has got two or three or four little gigs that she does. And sometimes, you know, we don't stay the whole meet, but we'll say, you know, a couple of 3 weeks, and she'll do some things there, and then she'll go back and forth and do them also. So that's a lot of fun there, and it's you know, she's in the business, I'm in the business, so you have a lot of common things, you know, so it works out good.
Yeah, I can imagine that the critiques wouldn't be very much, at least from my opinion anyways. I think Donna is undoubtedly one of the best that's ever covered racing on television. She's outstanding, and I think the world of her, so I can't imagine that you'd have very much to critique there. Let me segue here for just a couple of minutes, Frankie. We have about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we touch on this. It was recently announced that you have been selected for enshrinement into the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame. And being a native of New Orleans, this has to mean an awful lot to you. There are 7 Louisiana jockeys and 1 owner, John Franks, in that Hall of Fame. You will be the first trainer enshrined. What's it like to hear those words?
Well, you know, I never saw that coming. I got a guy call me, Doug Ireland called me to tell me that, and I never saw it coming. And he said, "Well, you're the first trainer." And I thought, man, that's pretty good to be the first trainer. You know, I really didn't see it coming. And it's quite an honor, especially as I told you earlier, I was always a city boy trying to play a country boy's game, you know, and to be the first trainer, only trainer, you know, to be in the Hall of Fame in Louisiana, it's just terrific. And it's who'd have thought, you know, as they say, I've still got to work on Saratoga, I guess, but it means an awful lot to be inducted in the Louisiana Hall of Fame.
How'd you get the news? Was it a phone call, a letter? How'd they notify you?
Well, actually, he'd called. It didn't leave a name, and I won't call back unless I know who it is. You know what I mean? So he got my wife's number, and she had to call and tell me, "Listen, this guy is going to call you now. Just answer the phone." So anyway, I was driving back from Keeneland, and so I talked to him on the phone driving back, and he told me, and so that's kind of how that went down.
When Frank Brothers gets a few minutes to step away and look back on your life and your career, what do you consider to be maybe the greatest accomplishment in the sport?
I always had a fear that, you know, I never wanted to be a flash in the pan, so to speak. And I was just very, very fortunate through pretty much all of my career not to have much downtime as far as the stable and the horses. I mean, sure, you had little spells where they didn't run as well, but I always had pretty nice horses and was always able to win some races, and that's what I was kind of my number one goal. I didn't want to be hot shot or, you know, do good for a month or a year, and then 2 years later you don't see the guy, you know, they're gone or whatever, you know. So I always tried to keep grounded. That was never a problem with me, and save my money and work as hard as I could, and, you know, try to run, do the best I could with the horses, and to try to keep a certain level throughout my career. And for a little guy, I think I've probably accomplished that, and that's made me feel very well.
Well, Frankie, you've always handled yourself with absolute class. I can remember the first time I met you, I was working in Horse ID at Keeneland, and that was probably 12 or 14 years ago now. And I just can remember how gracious you were in spending a little time talking with me, and I'll never forget it, and really had a great time hearing your story tonight on Trainer Talk, and want to wish you and Donna all the best moving forward.
I appreciate that, and thanks for having me, and tell your producer Lee that I appreciate everything, and looking forward to talking to you guys again down the road.
Frankie, thanks so much, and congratulations on your induction into the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame.
Thank you, and you guys enjoy. Have a good holiday.
All right, you too. Frankie Brothers here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. You talk about an ambassador for the sport. You talk about somebody who has done things the right way and learned this game from the ground up. He epitomizes what this sport, what the training profession is all about. That was an amazing hour. My thanks to Frankie Brothers here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Don't forget, you can catch us every single Wednesday night. If you missed any portion of this interview or any of our Trainer Talk shows, they're archived on our website, horseracingradio.net. You can go back and listen via podcast. You can listen on iTunes, listen on your smartphone or tablet as well. It's all there at Horse Racing Radio. HorseRacingRadioNetwork.net. Again, my thanks to Frankie Brothers for taking the time. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.